Salvi throws down to third. What a way to end the game.
It was a pickoff play there for Salvador Perez that ended the win for the Royals over the Angels on Tuesday night at Kauffman Stadium. Royals get a 3-2 victory over L.A. And we'll have more on the game coming up here on the Sports Ticket on Katy Country 94. We're going to take a look at local sports as well and then tell you about some transfers within some Kansas basketball programs in-state. The KU men and K-State women each had a transfer. Both fairly well-known there yesterday that are heading off and into the transfer portal and going elsewhere here for their to continue their education and their basketball playing. So stay tuned for all that coming up here on the Sports Ticket. We'll also have a look at the NBA. There's a very prominent player that is done for the season with an ACL tear. And then talk a little bit about the playoffs, which will be coming up not really too long from now, a little bit later than normal. But we'll kind of give an update on the NBA playoffs and or the picture, a playoff picture, and then some thoughts from a very outspoken owner about how the playoffs are being set up here this year. So that's all coming up here on the Sports Ticket on Katy Country 94. It'll be a little bit shorter show since we have gone kind of long the last couple of days. How about we have a little compromise here today? Before we get into the rest of things, though, let's take a look at local sports. Yesterday in softball, Clay Center won over Beloit 5-1 and 14-0 in five innings, getting a sweep over the Lady Trojans there in Beloit. Clay Center is now 6-0. Beloit dropped to 6-2, their first two losses of the season. And also in softball, Sylvan Lucas Lincoln winning 8-3 over Wichita Trinity and 14-4 in game two. So the Lady Mustangs get a sweep there. They're now 5-3 on the season. Wamego over Concordia 9-2 and then 10-0 in five innings. So Wamego gets a sweep. Concordia now 1-6-1. Baseball scores from the area last night. Clay Center sweeps Beloit 12-0 in five and 14-1 in five in game two. Clay Center now 7-1, Beloit 2-8 on the season. Lincoln Sylvan Lucas baseball team split with Bennington, taking the first game. Lincoln did 7-1, and Bennington won the second game 6-4. The Leopard baseball team now 3-5 on the season, and Concordia suffered their first two losses of the year, losing to NCKL foe Wamego 9-1 in game one and 15-14. A very high-scoring second game that Wamego slips past Concordia there in game two. Full baseball and softball scores from the NCAA and other teams in the area can be found at ncksports.com. Very busy day for track and field on Tuesday as well. Smith Center Redmond relays on the girls' side. Marysville won the team championship with 120 points. Phillipsburg was second with 105. St. John's the highest area team as far as standings were at fifth. And looking individually from the area, Jane Letourneau of St. John's took first place. We'll go to through the gold medal winners. You can find full results, by the way, for all this track and field at ncksports.com. 3,200, Jane Letourneau of St. John's was first place, 1,305.58. Also, Lauren Dubert claiming a couple gold medals as she won the pole vault at 10 feet even and also took the javelin gold medal, 137 feet 1 inch. For her 100-meter relay on the weight relay went to Thunder Ridge in first place. And actually, Tori Slavic of Thunder Ridge, also first place in the discus with a throw of 111 feet, 1 inch. Boys' side, Marysville won the team title with 112 points. Sarah Central second with 90. St. John's was third. Smith Center fourth throughout that top five in the area. Area gold medal winners at Smith Center on the boys' side. 200-meter dash, Braden Perez of St. John's at 23:30. Also, Caleb Eiler of the Blue Jays in the 3,200-meter run at 10:53.87. 4x100 weight relay for Smith Center took first. And the 4x100 freshman relay also first place for Smith Center. And a first-place javelin finish for Brenna Walker of Beloit, throwing 182 feet even. Stockton Invitational girls team standings. Hoxie first, 156. Lakeside second. Osborne third. Gold medal winners from the area. Trinity Looters of Osborne in the 400-meter dash, 107.17. Courtney Bentz of Lakeside won the gold in the 800, 247.24. Lakeside's portable 100-meter relay team took first place in 54.28. Caitlin Hallett also won the 300-meter hurdles for Lakeside in 50.92. And first place finish for Lauren Brummett in the triple jump, 33.25 for Lakeside, and she also won the javelin at 115 feet 1 inch. Riley Stramble Smith of Lakeside took first in the shot put, 32 feet 5 inches. Boys side, Hoxie wins first place as a team, 175 points. Osborne second, Lakeside was fourth. Gold medal winners from the area there On the boys' side, Jay Shona Blakeside won the 400-meter dash, 54-48. Reagan Bales of Osborne won the 800, 213-14. Also, first place finish for Rylan Klein of Osborne, Rylan Klein Hackert, in the triple jump, 40 feet, 8 and a half inches. Also yesterday in local sports, golf invitationals, the Osborne Invitational. Plainville won the team championship with 367, two strokes ahead of Osborne, who finished second with a 369. Smith Center was sixth. Individually, Parker Crowe of Plainville took first place, 73 on the score on the strokes. And then tied for fifth, Jackson Pinckney of Smith Center, Brandon Beffert and Dayton Lance both of Osborne. Grady Walters of Osborne was ninth to round out top 10 from the area. Minneapolis Invitational team title went to Ellsworth, 367 ahead of Sacred Heart in second with 373. Beloit finished fifth as a team. Individual champion was Morgan Newell of Sacred Heart, shooting an 84 on the day ahead of an 85 from Avery Haxton of Ellsworth in second. No Beloit golfers finished in the top 10. Garner Grauerholtz finished in 14th place for the Trojans. If you missed any of that, or if you want full results, it would take, I'd be here until probably about 10 o'clock just with local sports if I went through all the big results and great finishes from the area. So it's all posted again at ncksports.com. All of Tuesday's action that I just mentioned and full results there at the website. All right. As heard here at the beginning of the sports ticket, the Kansas City Royals picking up the win over the Angels last night, final of 3-2. Just kind of looking at the game, and the Royals got up 2-0 on RBIs from Carlos Santana in the first and 30. Had a sack fly in the first and then grounded out, but got the run in and drove in a run in the third inning. So both of his RBI came on plays where basically ended up being kind of a sacrifice. One was a legitimate sacrifice. The other one's not called a sacrifice, but in essence, it ends up being that. So they took a 2-0 lead. The Royals did, and they led 3-1 after Shohei Ohtani hit a solo homer off Royals starter Danny Duffy in the fifth. Actually, it was 2-1 at that point. But then the Royals got back up 3-1 as Salvador Perez drove Whit Merrifield in at the bottom of that inning, fifth, to take the lead up to 3-1. The Angels did get another run later in the game as they played a one against Wade Davis in the eighth. But in the ninth inning, despite having the bases loaded, Salvador Perez made the big pickoff of David Fletcher at third for the final out. And a 3-2 victory. Danny Duffy got the win, pitching six innings, allowing eight hits, just one earned run. Duffy's been probably the bright spot of, there's no probably about it. Duffy has been the bright spot of the Royals' rotation here so far this season, allowing just one earned run and two starts. So a great start to the season for Danny Duffy. So his ERA is now 0.75. He's 2-0. Threw right at 100 pitches last night, as manager Mike Matheny said it was the best he's seen Duffy. Obviously, Mike Matheny's only been the manager for the Royals for the last 2 years. So we've seen a Danny Duffy that's probably more dominant than that. He had a no-hitter at one point going into, I believe it was a seventh inning a few years back, and couldn't quite finish that one off. But again, Danny Duffy, an outstanding start to the season, a great game again yesterday. Did allow eight hits, as we mentioned, but did strike out six, gave up just one earned run, and went six innings. So, again, as you kind of look at the way the landscape of baseball and everything that's changed, six innings is a quality start and definitely more than what a lot of the Royals pitchers have been doing so far this season to start out the year. The Royals, again, with the win over the Angels there, are now 5-4 after a great performance from Duffy. I was doing a couple different things last night, but I did have the game on. I wasn't intently watching and seeing every play that happened in the game, but the Royals, it was a wild inning. When you see, I don't know if anybody saw it, but on that pickoff play where Fletcher was picked off by Salvador Perez, a pitch from Greg Holland looked like it was about to go wild. It hit the dirt and then hit Salvador Perez's glove, and then it ricocheted. And I think Fletcher, I'm not in Fletcher's mind, but it looked as though he anticipated and felt like that ball was just going to go flying off to the right and out of the way. But what happened was it didn't go flying, and it hit the Angels batter. Now I'm trying to get the I think that would be on the play-by-play. I'm struggling. I forget who was at the plate. Jared Walsh. That's who it was. Jared Walsh was at the plate for the Angels. And so it looks like it's headed out of the way. Like it's going right of Salvi. But it from the look that Fletcher had from down the third base line, you're going to see it might be headed out of the way, but it was actually bounced up and then a little bit still in front of Salvi and hit Mr. Walsh in a place that a man doesn't want to be hit after the deflection and after the bounce off the ground. So hit him right in a spot that you don't want to get hit in the midsection. We'll just put it like that. And it bounced back right to Salvi, and he rifled one down the third baseline and got Fletcher way too far off the bag there. But again, I think in that situation, I might have kind of done the same thing Fletcher did. I might have felt like, hey, that's bouncing off to the right. There's no way he's going to be able to reel that in and get it down here to third base. I'm going to head home, try to tie this game. But unfortunately, the bounce went the wrong way for the Angels, and definitely very unfortunately for Walsh. I'm sure he was wearing protection, but it was a tough one there, and Salvi made him pay for it. And the Royals get the win on a very heads-up and great play by Salvador Perez to get that ball right back, fire it down to third base, and get the out. So, again, the Royals do get that victory as Hunter Dozier was there to make the tag and finish off the win. They went and reviewed it, but, man, Fletcher, he knew. I mean, he left. He was already walking to the dugout for the Angels. And just chalk it up to a mistake on the base pass and a very great a great play by Salvador Perez. Mike Matheny, Royals manager, on that crazy ending, and Salvador Perez.
Yeah, I don't know if I've seen a game end quite like that one. But Salvi, we were talking about it before the pitch. You know, this is why he does so much work, extra work, blocking balls. You got a good idea when you get to 0-2 in that situation. There's going to be something from Greg spinning that's going to be pushing the bottom of the zone and a little help with, I think, kicking off the hitter. But for him to keep that in front of him all day long, he's blocked the ball so well all season long. He continues to impress us with the little things he's doing behind the plate that sometimes go unnoticed. But it's winning style baseball from behind the plate. Great win for us.
So Royals has been kind of a back and forth season so far, up and down to start 5-4. One of the things that, or some of the things that you have kind of seen from this game, Shohei Ohtani is, I mean, this guy's the real deal. 3-for-5, 3 RBI the night before last, and then last night 3-for-5 with the homer that came off of Duffy. He's been outstanding for the Angels, and what a great pickup for them to be able to do that and get Ohtani. Again, he's done some great things. Well, a couple other things. One of the things that definitely stood out last night was Mike Trout struck out 4 times. Royals got him 4 times, and I believe 3 of those were by Danny Duffy, if I'm not mistaken. I know at least 2. And then Greg Holland got him on a strikeout there in the ninth. Trout finished 1-for-5 for the Angels on Tuesday night. Again, 4 strikeouts. Not something he does a lot in a single game, obviously. I'm not saying Trout's not a guy that strikes out, but he is hitting .368 early this season. He got sat down 4 times by striking out there last night. So, again, Danny Duffy, a great game, and Jake Brintz came in and pitched a scoreless inning of relief for the Royals. Again, 6 innings for Duffy, so Brintz came in. And then Wade Davis pitched 2/3 of an inning, did allow a run. And then Greg Holland came out to get his first save of the season, a 4-out save for Holland. Obviously not the first save of Greg Holland's career with the Royals, as he spent a lot of time in the organization. And one of the things Dave Holtzman always has a lot of good nuggets there on Twitter about Royals baseball. And saw this one last night. The last time Wade Davis pitched in the eighth and Greg Holland picked up a save in the same game, September 17th, 2015, which was right before Greg Holland got injured there toward the end of that 2015 season. And Wade Davis had to step into the closer role there late and then into the postseason, in which the Royals ended up, as you know, winning the World Series back in 2015. And that was the last time that Wade Davis pitched in the eighth. Greg Holland to pick up a save. And the starter that night wore number 30, just like last night. Danny Duffy wore number 30 back in 2015. Obviously, it was Yordano Ventura wearing number 30, and he was a starter that night. And then Wade Davis and Greg Holland both pitched in the contest, and Holland picked up a save. So kind of interesting to see where the Royals have come full circle with some of these guys. You know, Davis and Holland and Gerard Dyson, they're all on the team again from that 2015 championship run. And you know, some of them that are still there, and the likes of Duffy that we just mentioned, and Salvador Perez, and some other guys that were part of that 2015 team. There's not a lot, not as many as there once were, obviously, as you get further and further away. The less and less chance you have of having those players on the team, but Salvador Perez appears to be one of those guys that could be a forever Royal, as the hashtag was, I believe, last year, I guess a couple years ago, and then right after the World Series. So you could see maybe Salvador Perez being that guy, but again, most of these guys that were on that 2015 World Series team are no longer with Kansas City, but it's nice to see that. And it's nice to see Wade Davis and Greg Holland come in and close out a game. Although Davis, again, did give up a run, it was not a overly costly one, as the Royals were able to hold on for a 3-2 win there on Tuesday night against the Angels. So the Royals, again, now 5-4. Angels dropped to 7-4 as the Royals and Angels will finish out their series coming up this afternoon at 1:10 at Kauffman Stadium. Brad Keller trying to get going on the mound there. Again, first couple games, he's definitely been a struggle for Brad Keller. He's 0-1 with a 19.29 ERA. He's pitched in just 4 2/3 innings, allowing 15 hits, striking out just 3 and walking 5, and giving up 2 home runs. It's been a rough, rough start for Brad Keller. For Griffin Canning, I believe this is just his second start for the Angels here this afternoon. This will be his second start of the year for Los Angeles. He gave up three hits, 7 strikeouts, and has a 6.75 ERA in just the one game that he's pitched in so far, 5 1/3 innings this season. So it's kind of interesting that Griffin Canning's pitched one game. He has 5 1/3 innings on the books so far this year. Brad Keller's pitched in 2 and has only amassed 4 2/3 innings pitched. So obviously Keller's a guy that they're looking forward to be the ace of this staff. He was the opening day starter, and he has struggled but has shown signs of having success in the past. Again, Brad Keller, the starter for the Royals. 1:10 first pitch from Kauffman Stadium this afternoon in Kansas City. All right, moving on. The transfers that are going on right now in men's college hoops. So just kind of looking at the numbers and a lot of different teams and schools, universities have seen transfers. And the latest to transfer is Kansas freshman Bryce Thompson. Thompson was a very highly touted recruit coming out of Tulsa's Booker T. Washington, I believe, is where he went to school. I don't have that right. Yep, Booker T. Washington, 6'5", 188 combo guard from Booker T. Washington in Tulsa. He chose KU over Oklahoma State, North Carolina in his initial recruiting process, but he is the latest and biggest now former Jayhawk that has announced that he's entering the transfer portal. He was a 5-star prospect out of Tulsa, McDonald's All-American, and was a very, very important piece of the class that of last year's freshman class, who have been in the class of 2020 coming into Kansas. I know Bill Self expected him to be a key contributor to the Jayhawk program, but his freshman season was riddled with injuries. He wasn't able to play as much as he would have liked. He had a back injury, then shortly just very shortly after coming back. It was actually in the first game coming back from that back injury. He broke his right index finger, and so he was very limited in what he was able to do this season. He appeared in just 20 games for KU and averaged 4.5 points, a rebound and a half, an assist in 17 minutes per game. Thompson did announce the news himself on Twitter shortly after a release yesterday. Thompson did say, quote, "While it was a difficult year for many reasons, I'm thankful to have had the opportunity to play at the University of Kansas. Thanks to Coach Self and his staff, the doctors, trainers, my teammates, and fans for your support all season long." Source close to the Lawrence Journal World, Matt Tate, wrote this story and said that it does appear that Thompson was headed back to Tulsa, but his next stop does remain to be revealed. But it sounds like there's a very good possibility that Bryce Thompson could play for the Golden Hurricanes. So we'll see how that ends up for Thompson. But Bill Self said after talking to his family, Bryce let us know that he's going to enter the transfer portal. I know Bryce had a tough freshman season with injuries, but I enjoyed coaching him this year through the ups and downs. We wish nothing but the best for the entire Thompson family moving forward. Again, Thompson, the fifth KU player that has entered the transfer portal. Again, this one, the most notable. They have had some additions, including Joseph Yesufu, the latest new addition to KU. But with the transfer portal and then likely departure of Marcus Garrett there for KU, KU could have just four scholarship players returning on its 2020-21 roster, and Christian Brown, David McCormick, DeJuan Harris, and Mitch Lightfoot. So, again, it's going to be a different year, different-looking Kansas team. Now, will that translate and be a better Kansas team? We'll find out. But it is a little interesting to see all the turnover within the squads. Ochai Agbaji, Jalen Wilson have entered the NBA draft. I brought up those names. That's if Agbaji and Wilson end up saying, yeah, we're going to stay in the draft, which I don't know about Jalen Wilson. I doubt he'll – I just really feel like both of those guys are going to be back next year. I really feel pretty strongly that Ochai Agbaji is going to be back. But, you know, I could be wrong on that. We don't know until we know, and that could be all the way until July. That's when they have the opportunity to make that decision, both Agbaji and Wilson. We'll have to make that decision about their futures by July. And so once we know that, we'll know more about what KU has. They do have two open scholarships right now. But if that would change, so, you know, if Abadjir and Wilson would both go, that would open up two more. So it'd be four scholarships that would be open. If only one of them goes, it would be three. Again, if they both stay, it's just two open scholarships. And KU will look to fill those. Again, they have filled some of those so far here in the off season. But it's been a wild and crazy offseason, but not just for Bill Self in Kansas. I mean, this is going on everywhere. So we've well documented there's many, many names in that transfer portal. 1,000 is the rough spot that we're kind of at right now with players that are in the men's Division I transfer portal. So, again, and actually, I think that's just the NCAA transfer portal, to be honest with you. I don't know if that's just Division I or if that's Division II guys as well. Because, again, there was a Division II that ended up coming up to Kansas from Central Missouri. And that guy's name has just slipped my mind. I was about ready to say it, and it's just right off the top of my head and gone. So KU has done a good job of filling some spots here. But, again, they do have a couple spots left. Some names that have been thrown around as far as that's concerned. Where did I see that? Ty Washington. He's a prep guard that could be a part of that. And then Creighton transfer Christian Bishop is a guy that KU's keeping an eye on as well that could possibly fill one of those spots. So we'll see if any of that happens. But Bryce Thompson, former All-American and five-star rated recruit for Kansas after just 1 year in Lawrence, is headed off to a different place and entering the transfer portal. So we'll keep an eye on all that. It's obviously something a lot of people are not a big fan of, seeing all the transfers, but kind of the times we're living in right now where it could be, you know, injuries cause you to say, nah, I don't want to be a part of this anymore, or you just move on. Adversity hits you and you just don't want to deal with it, so you move to a new school, or the fit's just not right, and sometimes that's the case as well. So Bryce Thompson entering the transfer portal, the fifth KU player to do that so far here in the off season. So we'll keep an eye on who they can fill those two scholarships with there at the University of Kansas. Kansas State women's basketball team also has a transfer to talk about, and that is Chrissy Carr. Chrissy Carr's been at K-State since, her freshman year. She's 3 years at K-State, and her dad, Chris Carr, is an assistant coach under Jeff Mitty, so I know there's probably some question marks as to whether Chris Carr will be back as an assistant coach as well. Kind of sometimes that might raise like a red flag hearing about that. But Chris Carr was not available for comment yesterday. They tried to reach out. I think Manhattan Mercury, I know their story said that they tried to reach out, but Chris Carr was not available for comment. So it'd be interesting to see if he's still on the staff at K-State with Jeff Mitty, or if he's headed somewhere else, and that's why Chrissy Carr has decided to enter the transfer portal. Carr was the first Manhattan High graduate to play for Kansas State women's team since Susie Norton, 75-76. Honorable mention, All Big 12 this past season, did post a career high in points, 15 per game, field goal percentage at 42.5%, and three-point percentage at 35% from three-point land. She definitely improved on her long-range shooting as her career went on, 35%. Still not like going to blow you away, but that was her best three-point shooting percentage, and also had her highest ever rebound total per game at just under 4.9 rebounds a game during her junior season. Carr did tweet about the decision. She said, "I want to start by saying thank you to the amazing loads of support you've shown me over the past 3 years. The second I moved to Manhattan, I felt loved by so many." She also thanked her teammates for the great memories there. And again, Chris was not available for comment Tuesday, and Chrissy Carr did say, "Playing for my dad has always been something I hold close to my heart, and I am beyond thankful that Kansas State has given me the opportunity to do just that." She's the only Wildcat to have entered the portal since K-State lost to West Virginia in the Big 12 quarterfinals. K-State went just 9-18 this past season. How they want to replace her production will be interesting to see how they can get that done. K-State does have Ioka Lee coming back. A decent core of players. They just had so many games where they were either leading or in it or whatever it might be, but they just couldn't finish off games. They say that's a sign of a good team is when you can, you know, win those close games and fight through that adversity. It was just a rough year, though, for K-State's women's basketball team, and now they'll look to replace their second leading scorer, Chrissy Carr, who has opted to transfer out of Manhattan. All right. One of the things we've been saying, I'm not gonna go deep into this, but one of the things we've been talking about lately is soccer and baseball and the popularity of baseball and how soccer is on the uptick, baseball's on the downside of where the popularity of the sport is. And it's funny, as we were talking about that, one of the most interesting things that I've seen in quite some time that can really back that up, right, is last night. So Alex Rodriguez, I gotta find the actual story. I thought I had it on Twitter, and now I've lost it. So I have to find this because it's just actually pretty funny once you look at it. So Alex Rodriguez, who over the weekend it was revealed that the former MLB star, along with billionaire Mark Lohr, are going to become the new owners of the Minnesota Timberwolves. And they've earned exclusive negotiating rights for the next 30 days. It's expected they'll finalize a deal with the Timberwolves' current owner, Glenn Taylor, during that time. So this is from CBS Sports on the story. I'm just going to read this just to kind of set it up. With Rodriguez set to take control of the NBA franchise, several Timberwolves players, including star big man Karl-Anthony Towns, are on board with the former Yankees third baseman taking control over. However, rookie Anthony Edwards isn't quite as familiar with Rodriguez. In fact, Edwards doesn't even know who Rodriguez is. Edwards was asked about Rodriguez taking over the team. His literal quote was, "I don't know who that is. I know he's going to be the owner, but I don't know anything about baseball." We're talking about Alex Rodriguez here, a guy that was for a very long time in his sport, the most well-known player, whether that was because of the big contract that he got, whether that was, first of all, just the hype coming up when he joined the Seattle Mariners back in the mid-90s. Was it the hype? It was, whether it was that or whether it was all the numbers he was putting up, the pace he had as far as home runs were concerned, as far as just the number of the deal that he got when he left Seattle and went to Texas, and then going to the most popular market, the most popular team in baseball history with the Yankees, and then the whole steroid thing where he lied and wasn't forthright and honest about what he had done. Alex Rodriguez ranks number 4 on the all-time home run list in Major League Baseball history, the all-time baseball stat. And Anthony Edwards like, yeah, don't know him. I don't know who that is. I don't know anything about baseball. Okay, Anthony Edwards, very young guy. Very young guy. And just what we're talking about, those demographics, those people that don't know and don't care about baseball, that average viewer for baseball being 57 years old. And so these younger kids, I don't know if I asked Anthony Edwards if he knew who any soccer players were. And I don't know a lot of the MLS soccer players. I'm going to be honest with you on that. But, you know, if you asked who Ronaldo was or Neymar or somebody like that, I don't know if Anthony Edwards would know who that is or not. But it is wild to me that – I shouldn't say that because it's not, because it's exactly what we're talking about with the younger generation, the younger group, the younger people not knowing a lot about baseball, not being into baseball, not watching baseball at all. But if you don't know anything about – I mean, there's people that don't know the game of baseball that know who Alex Rodriguez is. I mean, that's – well, it's Jennifer Lopez's husband. I mean, you can go outside of even the fact that he's a baseball player. Just go, I mean, he's just all over the place in popular culture and everything just because he's attached to Jennifer Lopez as well. And maybe Jennifer Lopez doesn't have the wide net as wide as it used to be, but seems like it is, but I don't know. That's just funny. When I saw that last night, I'm like, oh, wow. I don't know who Alex Rodriguez is. I know he's going to be a new owner. Don't know the guy. After Edwards said he didn't know who Rodriguez was, A-Rod shared an Instagram post about the situation, said, "Hi, Anthony, I'm Alex." Edwards shared the post on his Instagram and said, "What's good, my guy," with a laughing emoji. So even if he doesn't know who A-Rod is now, he'll be going to get to know him in the coming years when Rodriguez does own the team. So wild story there. Nope, don't know him. Don't know Alex Rodriguez. I think most, even a casual sports fan, usually knows those players that are at the top. I mean, if you're in the top 5 all-time in home runs, I'm going to say there's people that probably know who you are. And Anthony Edwards, nope, I don't know Alex Rodriguez. So that's a funny here for today. Something not funny from the NBA. Denver Nuggets guard Jamal Murray suffered a torn ACL in the loss to the Warriors on Monday night, and he is out indefinitely. He's been diagnosed with a torn ACL on the left knee. You tore an ACL, unless you're not going to have surgery on it, which in a young player in the NBA is, okay, first of all, I don't think you'll be able to keep playing. I don't think there's probably stipulations in the contract that say you can't play on a torn ACL. Now, I saw a thing floating around where there was one of the wrestling national champions in college. He's like, I was wrestling on 2 torn ACLs. Spencer Lee, I knew his last name was Lee, but I couldn't remember his first name for some reason. Spencer Lee, Iowa wrestler, he was a national champion, said he was wrestling on 2 torn ACLs, and immediately people were like, these guys are out with high ankle sprains in the NBA, and wrestling is just different. Listen, it may be, and the fight that they put into it, but I like people that are out with high ankle sprains are not out because they want to be out. I'm going to tell you that right now. They're out because teams in the NBA have put an investment in to those players. And contracts say, we need you healthy to be playing or else you're not going to get your money. And so that's most of the time anyway. There's going to be stipulations where, hey, you really need to do this. We appreciate your passion and drive and your want to continue fighting. Now, for Spencer Lee of Iowa, he didn't have to worry about moving on and getting a contract and losing a contract or losing playing time or anything like that as a college wrestler. And he made that decision. And a lot of these things are based on, I mean, you know, you've seen high school players, quarterbacks have success with torn ACLs. I saw it with my own eyes. In 2013, I don't bring up bad memories for Beloit fans, but it was Silver Lake Cougar quarterback there. So you do see these things happen, right, where athletes do play with torn ACLs and do try to fight through pain and things of that nature. So that's what Spencer Lee of Iowa did, right? Jamal Murray's not going to have that chance. The Nuggets are, I would imagine, just going to be like, okay, go ahead. You're going to get surgery. And you'll be ready to roll moving on. He enjoyed a breakout postseason last year. Jamal Murray did. He's been hobbled by injuries pretty much a lot of the year, but he is averaging 21 points, 4 rebounds, and just under 5 assists a game here this year. But Jamal Murray, a torn ACL in his left knee on Monday night and is out indefinitely, again, likely for the remainder of the what really you don't like about it, too, is there was just under 51 seconds left in the entire game when he was trying to split a couple defenders on a drive and kind of landed the wrong way on his left knee, and then there you go, torn ACL. I was actually watching it live because I was watching what Steph Curry was doing and setting the Warriors franchise record in scoring, so I was going to try to figure out how many he ended up with, and as I'm watching that, I'm like, oh, that's not good. Some people on Twitter were like, he might have hyperextended it. Now, I'm not a doctor. I don't try to be a MD on Twitter. But just his reaction, right? Just the way – it's one of those things where you know – I mean, maybe you heard or felt something pop in there, and it's just like, oh, I know this is not good. And you did that reaction from Jamal Murray on Monday night was not good. And I knew that the report probably was not going to be good when it came out, and it's absolutely not. So you move on and hope that things go well in recovery for Jamal Murray and he can become or get back to what he was and be the same player, because it is tough to see a 24-year-old like that go down with an injury. Obviously, we're so far advanced that, yeah, unless something weird would happen, he should be good to go and back to his old self at some point, but out indefinitely, Jamal Murray for the Denver Nuggets. All right, I'm going to play a funny thing at the end of the show here, but there's one other thing I want to talk about, and that's the NBA playoffs, which are coming up here. And what happened was this season was cut short because of COVID. It started a little bit later. They have just 72 games instead of 82, 10 games cut. So they've kind of expanded playoffs. They're having a little play-in tournament for the playoffs, and things are going to look a little bit different here in 2020-21 for this season. Luka Doncic from the Dallas Mavericks, I think of Denver Nuggets with Jamal Murray. Luka Doncic from the Dallas Mavericks was kind of critical of it, said he doesn't really like it. He criticized the idea of the expansion of the NBA playoffs to 10 teams and getting in. And I think what happens is 9 and 10 will play, and then the winner of that game will play the 8th seed for a chance to be the 8th seed in the NBA playoffs. So if I recall correctly, and I don't have all that in front of me, there might be more info in the story here. No, it is the 7 through 10 seeds that play in this. Scroll down, you'll figure it out. The 7th and 8th place teams will play each other, with the winner earning the 7th seed. So 7 and 8 play against each other. Whoever wins that does get the 7th seed. So the 9th and 10th place teams will play each other. The loser will be eliminated from playoff contention, and then the loser of the 7-8 game and the winner of the 9-10 game will then play to get that eighth playoff seed there in each the Eastern and Western Conference. So I had all the first part of it right, but determining who the 7th seed would be was where I kind of skipped that process of the postseason. So 10 teams will be into the playoffs. Four, the bottom four, 7 through 10, will be put into a play-in tournament, basically. I don't know if you call it a tournament for the 7th seed, but it would be a tournament, I guess, if you are the 10th seed and you make your way all the way to the 8th seed and end up picking up that spot. So that's kind of the way it works, but Mavericks owner Mark Cuban does not like it either. So Mavericks player Luka Doncic said he's kind of criticized it, and then but Cuban said in some messages to ESPN, he said, I get why the NBA is doing it, but if we're going to be creative because of COVID, we should go straight up 1-20 and let the bottom four play in. This is the year particularly to do it since the 10 games cut were in conference. So the worst part of this approach is that it doubles the stress of compressed schedule. Rather than playing for a playoff spot and being able to meet the being able to rest the players, the standings become clear. Teams have to approach every game as a playoff game to either get into or stay in the top six, since the consequences, as Lucas said, are enormous. So players are playing more games and more minutes in fewer days. NBA Board of Governors, which includes Cuban, unanimously approved a proposal to implement a play-in tournament for this season after the league used it for the first time before the playoffs in last summer in the bubble. So Cuban said, in hindsight, this approach was an enormous mistake. I don't understand the idea of a play-in. Luka Doncic said he played 72 games to get into the playoffs, and maybe you lose two in a row and you're out of the playoffs, so I don't see the point of that. Listen, I was not a huge fan of it even last year in the bubble. My team almost benefited from it as a Spurs fan, but and I'm going to tell you right now, this year my team as a Spurs fan will be most likely benefiting from it, right? They sit at 9th right now, and they would have to lose and really not play well down the stretch here to lose that. There are 20 games left for the Spurs, so 72-game regular season, so it's still a while before we know all these things that will be set in stone. I don't like the whole, oh, well, we got to go play every night. We got to go out. Normal times when the standings are more clear and things of that nature, we'll know where we're at and have a little leeway, a little wiggle room. And I just think that's kind of the mentality of a lot of people this day and age, is like, oh, we need to take a break. Okay, maybe you do. And I get it. I get, you know, that it's not the 90s anymore, not the 80s, whatever, that people wanted to play every game. You want to go out and play 82, and you want to play 30 to 40 minutes a game every time out. And some people would be like, no, I want to play 82-48. Like, I don't ever want to come off the floor. But I don't know if I am a big fan of the whole, oh, we got to go out and compete every night. Isn't that what you should be doing anyway in a sport? You got to go out and compete every night. Now, maybe you're not going to have the same guns, everybody out there every night, but you still want to go out there and be focused every night and play. But I do get the whole, like, especially in, like, the Western Conference historically. I mean, you have to fight your tail off just to get to the 8th spot. I mean, you've got to fight to get to the seventh seed. 29 and 24 are the Mavericks right now, and they would be in that spot. The 6th seed is 8 games above 500. In the Eastern Conference, the 6th seed, 2 games above 500. The Knicks have slid back into that 8th spot at 28-27, and just above 500. Charlotte Hornets, 1 game above 500. The 5 seed, just 3 games above 500. And the 4 seed, 5 games above 500. Mavericks are 5 games above 500 as the 7. The best team, they would right now be, let's see, 545 and 547. The Mavericks would be the 4 seed in the Eastern Conference right now. And they're the 7, and they're going to have to play in a play-in game. And I think that's where Mark Cuban's coming from. It's not about, I don't think it's about where they're at in the Western Conference. I think he's just like, hey, we would be number 4 in the East right now and not have to worry about any placement on a bracket or any play-in tournament or anything like that. So I think it does hold some merit. I think you're outweighed a little bit in the Western Conference compared to the East when, I mean, And I think that's why a lot of people are a proponent of just putting everybody together and not having conferences in the NBA playoffs. Take the top, what used to be top 16 teams, because there's eight teams in each conference that make the playoffs, so 16 total. And it used to be just like take the top 16 teams. So I kind of get where Mark Cuban's coming from that aspect. When you see the Knicks and Hornets and Heat and Celtics, three games above 500, this number five seed. So you're going to have the Celtics at three games above right now and the Heat at two games above. Just automatically, they don't have to play in any kind of play-in tournament when the Mavericks have a better record than them. I get it. I mean, I see where it comes from. And I was, like I said, I was not even a huge fan of adding that play-in last year. I know he's trying to get more games in. So I don't know. I don't know if I have the right answer for that. Well, if you feel like you have the right answers, just do the playoffs like you've always done the playoffs. 1 versus 8, 2 versus 7. But if you are going to have that tournament, I think Mark Cuban's idea is more of what a lot of people have talked about, but just putting 16 teams in and calling it good. So we'll keep an eye on that. Right now, the Sixers, the number one team. Actually, the Nets and Sixers are both tied for first in the East at 37 and 17. And in the West, the Jazz have the best record in the league at 41 and 14 as the number one seed. So just something to keep an eye on and talk about, I guess, there in the NBA. One other thing that I know I got to go find it because I had it pulled up. Aaron Rodgers has been the celebrity host on Jeopardy, and I want to end with this because it was hilarious yesterday. So obviously it's better if you can see the expression on Aaron Rodgers' face during all this, but I'm going to play this from yesterday. And this is Aaron Rodgers as a host of Jeopardy yesterday.
In the 1960s, these Midwesterners earned 5 NFL championship trophies. Green Bay Packers? Dennis, go
try
again,
title
I guess.
For 600.
They swept over the NBA, winning the title every year from 1959 to 1966. Eric?
What are the Boston Celtics?
Oh, you know that one, huh?
Aaron Rodgers there. Celebrity host, or guest host, I should say, of Jeopardy. They've been kind of alternating guest hosts ever since Alex Trebek's final episodes aired. So he's like, I'm the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers. Can't you get that one right, Green Bay Packers? Aaron Rodgers. I think he's doing a good job. Full disclosure, I DVR and watch Jeopardy every day. I think Aaron Rodgers is doing a fine job as a guest host there on Jeopardy. But that was comical there. There are five clues in each category. And in that championship category, it was based on championships from all big four sports teams. And every single one of them was answered correctly by at least one person, except that one. And you have the Green Bay Packers quarterback standing right in front of you asking the question. Funny, funny stuff right there from Aaron Rodgers and Jeopardy. All right, big thanks to everybody for tuning into the Sports Ticket today, and we will talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.